We've been going through the book of Acts, and we're in chapter 21 again today. And so if you want to turn your Bibles there, Audrey, can you put that on the back screen too? It's not on the back screen there. Chapter 21. This morning, I want to talk to you about rumors. How do we handle rumors? Not so much rumors that we spread or that others share with us, but what do you do when people are spreading rumors about you? How do you handle that? And I think this morning we're going to see through Paul's life some real wisdom about how to handle rumors that are being spread about you. Because if you're a parent or you're a leader or a business owner, if you're a leader in any capacity, more than likely you're going to experience some rumors about you, and you got to know how to handle them. What should you do? And it's going to be very interesting this morning to watch to see what Paul does with his, because, you know, in this particular section, I've entitled the message today, Good Intentions That Lead to Negative Consequences. Good Intentions That Lead to Negative Consequences. We're going to find this morning a great picture about how the church leadership in Jerusalem faced a situation with the Apostle Paul. There were rumors being spread about him, and how they wanted to resolve it and what the consequences were. And we're going to see this morning that the leadership in Jerusalem had the best intentions. They wanted everything to turn out really well, and it went south. And it reminded me that sometimes in our life, we can have the best intentions, we can do the right choices even, and sometimes things don't work out the way we expect them to work out. And sometimes along the way, people will say things about you. And how do we handle that? It's going to be a fascinating discussion this morning. We're in Acts chapter 21, and we're picking up our story in verse 17. Now, last week we ended with Paul and his team arriving in Jerusalem. Remember, Paul is finishing up his third missionary expedition, and he is in Jerusalem. He got there in time for the Pentecost holy holiday, so there are tens of thousands of Jews in Jerusalem. Paul arrived with his team, and we pick up the story in verse 17. And this is what it says. After we arrived in Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. You'll notice the pronouns we and us. That means Luke, who wrote the book of Acts, this historical account, was on Paul's team at this moment. They arrive in Jerusalem, so this is a firsthand account of what happened. And the brethren, the other Christians in Jerusalem, many who are Jewish Christians, in fact, all the Christians in Jerusalem for Pentecost would be Jewish Christians, because there's no reason for Gentile Christians to come to Jerusalem at this time. So the Jewish Christians greet us gladly. And the first thing that we notice here is that Paul reports to the Jerusalem leadership. And this is what it says in verse 18. And the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. Now, we know James. We've met him a couple of times in this book. He's the brother actually of Jesus, the half-brother of Jesus. And as the early church began to blossom, he was elected as the bishop of the massive church in Jerusalem. He was called James the Just because he had some kind of wisdom. He knew how to do right from wrong, and he was called James the Just. This is the brother of Jesus, who's the leader of the elder board in Jerusalem. All the elders were present. After he greeted them, Paul began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. So Paul is giving a report about what happened on the missionary journey all through the Roman Empire. He's come back to Jerusalem, he meets with the Christian leadership, and he's giving a report. Now, he's done this every time. Back in chapter 14, verse 22, he did this at the end of his first missionary journey. In chapter 18 and verse 22, he did it at the end of his second missionary journey. And now at the conclusion of his third and final missionary expedition, he does the same thing. He's giving a report. Verse 20, and when they heard it, they began glorifying God. So the leadership celebrates with Paul. They're saying, wow, we can't believe how God has used your ministry to reach people all throughout the world. It's incredible. But then in verse 20, they say, Paul, there's a problem. And the problem is rumors. Let's see what the rumor is. In verse 20, and they said to him, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. What's he saying? He's saying, hey, Paul, look around Jerusalem right now. There are tens of thousands of Jews in this city, and there are literally, he says there, thousands of those among the Jews who have believed. There are thousands of Jewish Christians here in Jerusalem, Paul, and you'll notice that they are observing and they are zealous for the law. In other words, Paul, the Jewish Christians that are in Jerusalem are here because they've taken some of the sacred ceremonies of their faith in the past, they've combined it with their new faith in Jesus, and they've come to Jerusalem to participate in the Pentecost holiday ceremonies. In other words, these Jewish Christians had no problem assimilating some of the stuff from Moses into their new Christian faith. In fact, many of the ceremonies and rituals that were prescribed by Moses gave a picture of the Messiah. And so being followers of Jesus, who was the Messiah, it was wonderful to participate in some of these rituals as a Christian because now you really get the meaning of them. But James says to Paul, Paul, there are, look, thousands of Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, and they are zealous for the law. They're following the Pentecost holiday. Verse 21, and they have been told about you. There it is. The rumor that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. You know what they're saying? Paul, there's rumors going around about you. And here's the rumor. When you come into Israel, you act like a good Jewish Christian. But when you are among the Jews outside of Israel, among the Gentiles, you teach them something completely different. Paul, the rumor is that you teach one thing in Jerusalem and you teach another thing outside of Israel. They have been sharing this rumor about you. And here's the specific examples. He says there in verse 21, you've been telling them not to circumcise their children. That's the sacred sign of the Jewish culture. Forgetting Moses' sacred sign from God and not to walk according to the customs. That's the sacred ceremonies. Paul, the rumors are that when you're not in Israel, you're telling the Jewish people among the Gentiles that they don't have to do the sacred sign. They don't have to follow the sacred ceremonies. And then verse 22, it says, what then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come here. You understand the situation? James is saying, Paul, it's been great what you've been doing out there, but now that you're here, I just got to tell you, there's some rumors going around about you, and the rumors are pretty serious. That what you teach in Jerusalem is one thing, but you are two-faced because you teach something completely different when you're outside of Jerusalem. And you're teaching people to forsake Moses, to forsake the sacred sign, to forsake the sacred ceremonies. What should we do, Paul? What are we supposed to do about the rumors? See, when people are spreading rumors, I guess you have like three choices. You can ignore the people and let the rumors go. And hopefully they die out. You can call a meeting with all the people and try to explain to them the situation. Or you can do something publicly to either denounce or to prove the naysayers wrong. And so the leadership in Jerusalem is trying to figure out what should they do. What should they do? Now, we know a lot about rumors. We know that the Bible teaches us that rumors shouldn't be a part of what we do. There's a myriad of verses in the Bible about rumors. Proverbs chapter 18 says, the words of a whisperer are like dainty morsels, and they go down into the innermost parts of the body. We love rumors. It's like a piece of steak going down. You know what it's like when you wake up in the morning and you're tired and trying to wake up and you get that first big drink of coffee and it like livens up all your body. The writer of Proverbs is saying, when we hear rumors that are juicy, we really like it. We do, don't we? So there's something about our human nature that likes to hear the dirt about other people. And so the Proverbs writer is just being honest that as human beings, rumors shared with us about other people, they taste really good. That's the dark side of social media, right? That's why millions and billions of dollars have been made just spreading rumors about people through magazines and TV shows and social media. That's where we got to be careful, because we as human beings, we love the taste of dirt on other people. Somehow it makes us feel better about our lives. There's another verse in Proverbs chapter 11. It says, he who goes about as a talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is trustworthy conceals a matter. So that's how we're supposed to respond. We're supposed to be God's people, that we conceal things. We keep secrets. We don't share secrets. And I like Proverbs chapter 26, verse 20 and 21. For lack of wood, the fire goes out. And where there is no whisperer, contention quiets down. Hey, if you take the wood out of the fire pit, the flame goes out and the coals get cold. Same with contention in a community of people when people stop whispering about one another. If you remove the whisperer, contention in the group goes down because people aren't spreading stuff. And it says, like charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a contentious person to kindle strife. It only takes one person to keep kindling the fire of rumors, to keep contentions going within a community. And so the Bible clearly instructs us, hey, don't get involved in them. Yes, they're tempting. Yes, they taste good when they go down, but let's be godly men and women, and let's conceal secrets and hold them in our vault, and let's not be people that spread them around or keep contention going. But the leadership in Jerusalem asked a question in verse 22, what then is to be done? Now, these rumors aren't true. We're going to find that out this morning. So Paul knows the rumors aren't true. The Jewish leadership team probably knows these rumors aren't true either, but there's a lot of people talking about them. So what should they do? And so what they decide to do in verse 22 is this: they will certainly hear that you have come to Jerusalem. Verse 23, therefore do this that we tell you. And it's a command. Paul, these rumors are flying around Jerusalem. And so we want you to squelch the naysayers and quiet the rumors by performing a ritual. And here's the ritual. It says in verse 23, we have four men who are under a vow. There are four men in this church, he would say, that are going through this Nazarite vow. If you like to underline words in your Bible, underline the word vow, and in your margin, write Nazarite vow. Because the Nazarite vow comes from the Old Testament. And it talks about a couple of different things. There are three main components. You can see them on the screen. The first component is you must abstain from fermented drink. In the ancient culture, the way you celebrated life was to have wine. That was part of the symbol of the celebration of life, the good things in life. And so when you went through the Nazarite vow, you abstained from rejoicing about life or partying, so to speak, and you wanted to focus your attention on your relationship with God alone. So you set aside celebratory items like wine. So one of the requirements is that you didn't drink wine. A second requirement is that you wouldn't cut your hair, because in the Jewish culture, cutting your hair was very important, and that was kind of like telling people, hey, during the vow time, I don't want you to focus on yourself. I don't want you to focus on celebrations. I also don't want you to focus on yourself. This time of the vow is for you and God to grow in your relationship, so I don't want you to cut your hair, because I don't want you to focus on your own looks and grooming and your fashion. I want you to set that aside, so don't cut your hair. And then thirdly, don't touch a dead body, whether it's an animal or a person. In other words, don't do anything that is unclean. Live a holy life. And so people in Jesus' day and in Paul's time here, they would take a vow, and for 30 days or for 60 days or maybe even for 90 days, you would take the Nazirite vow, and you would say, for the next 30, 60, or 90 days, I just want to focus my relationship with God. I want to set everything else aside. So I'm going to set aside all the celebrations of life. I'm going to set aside my own personal issues. I'm going to set aside anything that is unclean, and for 30, 60, or 90 days, I'm just going to focus on my relationship with God. That's the Nazirite vow. And there are four men in the church that are walking through this. The last 7 days of the ceremony, you would go to the temple, and for 7 days in a row, you would perform ceremonies or rituals, and you would give offerings and sacrifices. And it was kind of expensive because you had to shave your head to make sure that you, to signify that you were done with the ceremony. And then you would give an offering each day, and you had to pay for all the offerings that you were giving. So it was kind of expensive. And so the leadership in Jerusalem says, Paul, there are four of us taking the vow. Now, verse 24, take them, Paul, again, it's a command, and purify yourself among them. Paul, we want you to go to the temple, and in front of everybody, we want you to perform this ritual. Purify yourself with them. And then it also says, and pay their expenses so they may shave their heads, so that everyone will know that there's nothing to the things which have been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. So Paul is asked or commanded to do this ritual just so the naysayers will be quieted. We want you to go to the temple. We want you to perform this ceremony. We want you to pay for these four guys. So why? So that everybody that's talking about you will quiet down and the rumors will cease. What would you do if you were asked to do that? Would you say, I don't care what people are saying about me? Or would you do it? Now, they wrap up this particular section in verse 25 by saying, but concerning the Gentiles who have believed, we wrote, having decided they should abstain from meat sacrificed to idols and from blood and from that which is strangled and from fornication. So the leadership are saying, you know what, Paul? We don't have an issue with what the non-Jewish Christians are doing. We've already addressed that. We wrote about that. That's Acts chapter 15, the Jerusalem Council. We're not talking, Paul, that you need to satisfy the Gentile Christians. We're talking about the Jewish Christians that are in Jerusalem. There are many of them that are spreading rumors about you because they've heard about what you've taught outside of Israel. So please, we're begging you, we're commanding you, go do this ritual, go purify yourself for 7 days, and pay for the four guys that are going to be joining you. What would you do? Well, Paul, in verse 26, he performs the Nazirite ceremony. Verse 26, Paul then took the men, and the next day, see how quickly he responds, purifying himself along with them, he went into the temple, giving notice of the completion of the days of purification, the last 7 days, until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them. Paul performed the Nazirite ceremony. And the only reason he had to perform it was because the leadership thought the best way to squelch the rumors about you is to publicly demonstrate that they're wrong. That they're wrong. So you can ignore the naysayers. You can try and get them together and convince them that you're true, that you're right and they're wrong, or you can do something publicly to try and squelch them and quiet the rumors. And the leadership decides, probably with the best intentions at heart, they decide to go public with their confrontation of the rumors by having Paul perform this ceremony. Now, I tried to dig out, well, what would Paul be thinking? Would Paul really be disgruntled about doing this? Would he willingly do this ceremony? Is he just submitting to the leadership of the church and doing what they asked, even if he felt it was unreasonable? Why? What would Paul be thinking? And there's a couple of verses that I want you to look at. Paul did this, you know, and back in Acts chapter 18, so if you're in chapter 21, go back just a couple of chapters to chapter 18 and verse 18. And we're going to find out Paul did not have a problem performing this ceremony because he had performed it before as a Christian. In chapter 18 and verse 18, it says, Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria. And with him were Priscilla and Aquila. Now watch the last verse in verse 18, their last sentence. In Centuria, he had cut his hair, for he was keeping a what? A vow. Paul had performed this purification ritual before as a Christian. And so for them to ask him to do it again was fine. He didn't have a problem at all with the ritual. If you go over, keep your finger there in chapter 21, and let's go to a couple of books to the right, to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 19. Here's Paul's attitude. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19. For though I am free from all men, in other words, I don't have to listen to their laws, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win more people for Christ. To the Jews I've become as a Jew, so that I might win Jews. You'll notice he says there in verse 20, to the Jews I have become as a Jew, so as I might win the Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though myself not being under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. Hey, there are people that are really wrapped up in the Old Testament law of Moses, and when I want to tell them about Jesus, I don't mind performing some of the rituals of the Old Testament law, because there's nothing wrong with them. In order to help me to have a witness to people. Sometimes we get confused and we think that if we're going to witness to somebody, they have to leave their turf and come into our turf. And Paul is saying, no, if anybody's going to be uncomfortable, I'm going to be uncomfortable sharing the gospel. I'm going to leave my normal turf and I'm going to go to their turf, and I'm even going to sometimes dress like them. I'm even going to act like them sometimes so that I can tell them about Jesus. Verse 21, and those who are without the law, as though without law, not having been without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are without the law. Verse 22, to the weak I've become weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that by all means some will get saved. Is that our attitude? Hey, when we talk about how to make Jesus famous among people, do we make people leave their turf and come to our comfortable turf to hear about Jesus? Or are we willing to leave our comfortable turf and go to their turf to tell them about Jesus? Again, a second reason why Paul has no problem performing this ritual, because he wants to help people know Jesus. And if performing this ritual will help the Jews in Jerusalem, the Christian Jews, walk more closely to Jesus and listen to his testimony, then he's more than happy, he's more than willing to do it. So I think Paul's attitude was, whatever it takes to help people grow in their relationship with God, as long as it's not a sin, I'm willing to participate in any of those things. So he performs it. Now I want you to notice in your notes there that he is with sacred people performing a sacred ceremony in a sacred place. This is going to be important in just a moment. Notice again, he went to the temple with four Jewish men, and he is performing the purification ceremony. That's really important for us. So Paul submits. But the result in verse 27 is that the naysayers become violent. Let's look at verse 27. When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia. If you like to underline words in your phrases, underline the Jews from Asia. The Jews from Asia were the Jews that harassed Paul the most in his life. If we were to take a study of the Jews from Asia, we would find that regularly in Paul's three missionary journeys, this was the group that harassed him the most. This was the group that tried to kill him earlier, that stoned him and left him for dead. This is the group that riled up city after city and actually followed Paul certain times of his missionary journeys, stirring up the Jewish crowds to be against Paul. The first time this group is mentioned, Jews from Asia, is way back in Acts chapter 9 when Stephen is stoned to death. And it says that when Stephen stood up and preached about Jesus, it was the Jews from Asia that publicly opposed him. And so the Jews from Asia have been this group of people that have been denouncing the Christian movement among the Jewish people ever since Stephen was stoned. And they've been following Paul around. And now they're in Jerusalem celebrating Pentecost like everyone else. And as a group of them are walking past the temple, they see, lo and behold, there's Paul there. And so they run back to their little quarters and they get their group of critics and naysayers and they start sharing the rumors again and they rally together and they become a violent mob against Paul. Let's see what happens. It says, when 7 days were almost over, I'm in verse 27, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up the crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches." Now watch the words that are used here. "This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere." You see how naysayers and gossips always exaggerate? All men everywhere. No, James had already said the rumors are about what Paul shares outside of Israel, so it's not all men everywhere. Now notice what they say. He preaches to all men everywhere against our who? Against our people. He is anti-Jew. But wait a minute. He's in the temple with four Jews. And it says there in verse 28, and against the law, capital L, the law of Moses. He's anti-Moses. But wait a minute. Paul is performing Moses' ceremony, the Nazarite vow. So he's with sacred people performing a sacred ceremony, and this crowd is starting to say, "Hey, he's against our people." No, he's not. He's with four men right now. He's anti-Moses. No, he's not. He's performing the Nazarite vow. And number three, and he's against this place. He's anti-temple. No, he's not. He's actually in the temple. So you can see how the three accusations are completely false, but it's stirring up the crowd. That's the danger of rumors, that even false rumors can gain traction because they're like dainty morsels that go down. And the fourth accusation is at the end of verse 28. And besides this, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. Man, Paul, he has gone ballistic in his theology because he even brought a non-Jewish man into the temple. But look at verse 29. For they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with him. And they had, what's the word there? Supposed, assumed that he had brought him into the temple. So these people see Paul with these four Jewish men. Their heads are all shaved. They said, this guy is anti-Jew. He's anti-Moses. He's anti-temple. And they must have taken one of the bald guys for Trophimus, because they said he's even defiled the temple. But they were wrong. They had seen Trophimus with Paul the day before in the city, and they assumed that one of the four men with Paul was Trophimus, but he wasn't. He wasn't even in the situation. But they're still promoting this idea that Paul has defiled the temple by bringing a non-Jewish person into it, and they were completely wrong. They saw Trophimus the day earlier in the city and assumed he was one of the four guys, but he wasn't. But it doesn't stop them from spreading the rumors. What I learned in this passage is that you can't stop naysayers. You can't get people that want to gossip to stop gossiping. Because here, Paul is doing exactly what James said. James said, you know what? I think these rumors will go away if you hang out with sacred people and you perform a sacred ceremony and you do it in the most sacred of all places in the temple. If people just see you do that, the rumors will die. And so Paul says, sure. And so he grabs those four sacred men and he performs this sacred ceremony in the sacred place. And the gossipers spread them anyway. I'm not sure that standing up publicly or doing something publicly to quell rumors, to squelch rumors and to quiet whisperers is the way to handle it. Because in this example, it didn't do them any good. They just flat out lied and spread rumors about Paul. It doesn't make any logical sense for these Jews from Asia to say Paul is anti-Jew when you can see him standing there with four Jewish men. Paul is anti-Moses when his head is shaved because he's performing the ceremony. Paul is anti-temple when he's been spending almost 7 days now in the temple performing the ritual. And Paul is bringing Greeks into the temple because we think maybe one of those guys with him is a guy that we saw the other day, and they, and there's the key word, supposed, assumed, that Trophimus was one of the guys with Paul. And he wasn't. So all four of the accusations are completely false. Completely false. But it doesn't stop the crowd. Look at verse 30. Then all the city was provoked. You know that word provoked. It means to be moved emotionally to anger. Sometime in your family, you have been provoked. Every family has that situation that happens. They provoke to anger, and the people rush together, taking hold of Paul, and they dragged him out of the temple and immediately shut the doors. This is so funny. The people that were managing the temple, the priests that were managing the temple, thought, oh no, if there's a Greek in here, it's defiled. Oh no, if they grab Paul and they take him outside of the temple gates and they kill him and some of the blood splatters into the temple grounds, it's going to defile the temple. So it says when they pushed him out of the gate, they immediately shut the doors because the people inside want to keep this place holy for God. You see the hypocrisy there? The people that were managing the temple didn't care about the false rumors. They didn't care about Paul being drug out by his hair. All they wanted to make sure is that, boy, you don't defy the temple. So they immediately shut the doors. It's just an indication that all of the Jewish leadership had such a wrong understanding of what was taking place within the movement of Christ, and they were stuck in their old ways. Verse 31. And while they were seeking to what? Man, they were going to kill Paul. I mean, this was not like, you know, posting things on Twitter. This is like dragging you by your hair out into the street to end your life. This is a Middle Eastern of what we see today. That they were going to kill him. It says, while they were seeking to kill him, a report came to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. And at once he took along some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped what? Beating Paul. They were going to beat him to death. Now, the Roman commander was alarmed when he heard that there was confusion in Jerusalem because his leadership had told him, the Roman emperor had said, if I'm going to put you in charge of this area, there needs to be no rioting. And so when the commander heard that there's a chaos taking place in Jerusalem, he hurries and goes down to quell it, because if word gets back to the emperor that I am not in control of my region, I'm going to be removed as the commander. So he takes a bunch of soldiers and he goes down there and he stops them from beating Paul. The commander, the Roman commander, steps in. They stopped beating Paul. Then the commander came up and took hold of him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. Now, if you like to underline phrases in your Bible, underline two chains. That's significant. He arrests Paul with two chains and began asking who he was and what he had done. But among the crowd, there was shouting, verse 34, but among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another. And when he, the commander, could not find out the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. When the commander raced down, some people were shouting, Paul is an anti-Semite. Paul is a defiler of the temple. And there was so much confusion and there were so many things being shouted back and forth. The commander couldn't get a straight understanding of the situation, a straight answer. So he takes Paul, puts him in two chains, and takes him to the barracks. Verse 35, and when he got to the stairs, he was carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob. Paul had been beaten. Probably couldn't walk very well, was chained up. And so when they got to the stairs leading to the Roman jail, he couldn't walk up fast enough, and the mob was pressing in to get a hold of him. And so the soldiers literally picked Paul up and carried him up the stairs so they could get inside quickly. For the multitude, verse 36, the multitude of the people kept following them and shouting, away with him. So much for squelching the rumors. Good intentions turned wrong. He removes him from the crowd. Now, my question is, where is God during all this? If you were Paul, wouldn't you be asking that question? Hey, God, what's this all about? As you sit in the barracks with a bruised body and a black eye or two, bloody lip, chains, you didn't do anything wrong. You were just doing what the church leadership asked. You were trying to help those confused about following Jesus follow him more fully. And now you're sitting in barracks, battered and bruised. And he must have thought, God, what's going on here? Actually, I don't think Paul thought that at all. I think Paul had a different set of thoughts, and I want to end with this today. See, God had foretold of this event. Now, I use the word foretold because God doesn't predict. See, when people predict the future, it means they're guessing. God never predicts the future because God controls the future. So God foretells things. He doesn't predict. And I love Isaiah chapter 46 and verse 10 that says, God declares the end from the beginning. Did you catch that? God declares the end from when? From the beginning. He declares it. This is what's going to happen. And it says there, not only does he declare the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things that have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established and accomplished, all my good pleasure. God's going to do what he has planned. In Acts chapter 21, we saw last week in verse 10, 21 verse 10. Remember, Paul was at the really cool guy Philip's house, and he gets a visitor, and the visitor is a prophet. And the prophet says in verse 10, and as they were staying there for some days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. Coming to us, he took Paul's belt and bound his own feet and hands and said, this is what the Holy Spirit says. In this way, the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. So as Paul is sitting in the barracks, I think he thought about Agabus. Because Agabus had told him, when you get to Jerusalem, the Jews are going to lay hands on you. Exactly what happened. They're going to bind you, and they're going to turn you over to the Gentiles. So here's Paul sitting in the barracks. He's been beaten up by the Jews. He's been handed to the Gentiles, and he's in chains. And I think Paul thought, this is exactly what God said was going to happen. And when you're sitting where God has you, he must have also understood that God was maneuvering the human events. In verse 33, it says, the commander came up and took hold of him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. Why was Paul bound with two chains? Seems excessive. Why did the Jews from Asia happen to walk by the temple at that time? How did the Jews from Asia stir up the whole city? Paul must be sitting there thinking, God maneuvered human actions to fulfill what he said was going to happen to me. So he had to be thinking, you know, God is the one that brought the Jews from Asia by, because if they'd come by an hour later, I might not have been standing there. He's the one that stirred up the crowd. He's the one that brought the soldier in. He's the one that convinced the commander to bind me with two chains. So now I'm sitting in this barrack and I'm thinking, you know, God foretold this and God maneuvered human actions to make this happen. Therefore, God is here. I think Paul sitting in the barracks had a strong sense that God's here. Because look what he did. He foretold this. He maneuvered human actions. And now I'm sitting here in the barracks, bound by chains. See, sometimes when we go through difficulties, we think God is paying attention to someone else. We think God is busy over there. And what we don't often see in our difficulties are the signs that God is here. See, I think that if we look at our difficulties, if we look at the details of our difficulties, we will see the fingerprints of God, which should tell us that God maneuvered events so that I'm here. And if God orchestrated my life so that I am in the barracks, that means that God is with me in the barracks. See, I think that God told us, didn't he, that in this life we will have what? We're going to have difficulties. We're going to have difficulties because we live in a fallen world. We live with fallen people. We're going to have difficulties because we're trying to follow Jesus and swim upstream from other people in our life or the culture in which we live. And those entities are going to cause us to have problems. So God foretold we're going to struggle. And then when human events get orchestrated to the point where we struggle and we go through heartache and we go through difficulty or rumors are being spread about us and we're just trying to do the good things in life and somehow we find ourselves in bondage, we need to remember God said this was what life was going to include and God is in control of the things that I'm not in control of. Therefore, the situation in which I find myself should communicate to me, God isn't out there, but he's actually right here. And I think Paul had a real strength at that moment because he thought of Agabus. And he thought, wow, the last 2 hours of my life have been orchestrated by God. Therefore, God isn't neglecting me. God is actually telling me that he's here. And Paul drew strength from that. When you and I go through difficult situations that aren't within our control, we need to look for the fingerprints of God to assure us that God isn't out there, but that God is right here. And I would venture to guess if we could talk to many of you who have gone through deep waters, looking back, you can see the fingerprints of God all over it. So let's try and see those fingerprints while we're in it. Because these are true for us today. God foretold we're going to have difficulties. God orchestrates his purposes and plans for our life that include difficulties. So when we're going through sorrows and difficulties, we shouldn't say God has left. We should see those signs as the assurance that God is here. You see how Paul did that? Sometimes you and I don't understand why we're going through the things that we're going through. We have the best intentions, but negative consequences take place. And when you're sitting in the barracks of your struggle, let's look for the fingerprints of God, because they will comfort you knowing that he is here, that he hasn't abandoned you. Remember the Agabus in your life and remember God's maneuvering situations to do what's best for you and to give him the most glory, and he's with you, he hasn't abandoned you. I think that's what Paul was thinking about in the barracks, because we're going to see later on what he thought while he was there, and that's what he thought. God is here. He hasn't abandoned me. The things that happen in our life are not arbitrary. They're not random. They're specific events that God has orchestrated so that he can do his best work in you and his best work through you. When we go through the ringer, let's look for the fingerprints of God. Amen? Let's stand together and pray. Lord, none of us enjoy the barracks of life. None of us enjoy the difficulties that we face at the hands of others. But Lord, you told us that in this life, we're going to have difficulties. You told us that if we want to live for you, people are going to resist that. You told us that if we want to stand up for you, people are going to shout down. You told us that we're going to suffer physically, emotional setbacks. We're going to live in a world of sin and disease, but that you are greater than the things of the world. And Lord, many of us have gone through those difficult times, and we feel, in a sense, like we're in the barracks, chained. But Lord, help us to look for your fingerprints as reminders that when we're going through the deepest water, that's when you are the most strongly present in our life. Help us to get our eyes off the circumstance and to get our eyes on you. Show us how to do that each day. We pray in Jesus' name.